Welcome to Bi Plus, podcasting for the Bi Plus universe. I'm Elizabeth Meacham, and I'm here with my co-host, Mick Collins. Today, we welcome Dr. Serena Anderlini D'Onofrio, also known as Dr. Serena Gaia, expert in ecosexual love, as well as founder of Scuola del Amore Ecosessuale.
Scuola dell'Amore Ecosessuale, which means the School of Ecosexual Love. Yes.
Dr. Serena, could you please tell us a bit about yourself and where you're from and with all the...
Yes, I'm very happy to do so. And it will take me some time because my story is a bit long since I've been around for a while. So I was born and raised in Rome, Italy. I was 14 in 1968 when there was a big revolution in most European capitals. And I came from a family that was, you know, well-to-do, but a bit eccentric. Like my parents were Montessorian. Yeah. And they were also, I would say they were nudists in the sense that at home we were not supposed to lock ourselves in the bathrooms or be ashamed of our bodies at any time. So it was a quite of a eccentric family of the 60s.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's how I grew up. And then, and then I lost my mother. Our mother died at a young age when we were very young. So our lives changed quite a bit on that loss. And then, you know, to make a long story short, at some point after I graduated from the Italian university as a foreign language and literature major, I decided to do my graduate studies in California. And that was the biggest jump of my life. It was like 9 time zones, landing in a land that in many ways resembles Italy, except that to the east of California, there's a desert, not another sea, but that also has all the beautiful colors and the artsy people that I was accustomed to being around, and also the cinema people, because Rome was, of course, a big center of cinema in the 50s, and so was LA. So I went to the University of California, Riverside, and I did all my graduate studies there. And then later on, when I was taking a break from all the academic world, I lived in San Diego. It was in the 90s, and that's where I met the second largest bisexual community in the United States. The biggest one was in Boston at that time. It was a community of about 200 members. We had monthly support meetings, and we had also monthly parties where you were invited only if you went to the meetings.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Weed out the people that are out there.
And it was founded by Fritz Klein, the author of The Bisexual Option, 100% Intimacy. And it was at that time conducted by Regina Reinhart, who even this year sent me her Christmas wishes. And so that was a big opening for me. It was like, okay, it felt like home. It felt like family. It felt as if I was welcome. All the different parts of me were welcome. I had up to that point been mostly heterosexual. I mean, I had been involved with men. I liked men enough that I, you know, there was no reason to in the dichotomous world of that time, there was no reason to question that. You liked men well enough. So why would you want to, you know, find out more? But then I felt that other part of me needed to come out, that similar situation would repeat themselves in relationships with men, that where something was missing. Mm-hmm. So finally, I found out that I wasn't alone. All my stories had been experienced before in a different form in this beautiful support group. In the last 2 years that I was in San Diego, I became a coordinator with another woman. We were co-coordinators of this large organization. And that really was my training ground to in the work of organizing events, managing, expanding and supporting community associations that have to do with different love styles and lifestyles and different kinds of orientations. So it was a great gift to be able to do that at that time. And it was like really a blessed time because in San Diego, many people had these beautiful homes with backyards, with carpeted floors, with jacuzzis. So I won't describe you all the details of what happened at the parties, but it was a lot of fun. And it was a way to really realize that this whole idea, you know, the Freudian idea that you always make love behind closed doors, making sure that nobody hears you, that the children are asleep, and that it's very, very private, is where I discovered that that was a pure invention of, I would say, of capitalism, of this kind of privatization of the practices of love that really has very little to do with human nature, or at least with certain aspects of human nature, like the bonobo-esque aspects, for example. So to close this 90s decades, my two subsequent decades are when I moved to Puerto Rico, because I decided to go back to my academic career from this period, mostly as an activist. And that's where I found a job that paid, that paid well, and that offered good opportunities also of a kind of a free research agenda. And that's how I could develop a whole research program that had to do with really turning the experience of our bisexual communities into an object of academic studies. This was the time when in academe, queer theory was in fashion. So if you did queer theory, everything was fine. You could be in any research one type of university. But if you wanted to do something that was more related to the specificity, to the concreteness of life in the communities that practiced all these different kinds of queernesses, you know, that existed, including bisexuality, then it was more problematic. And so I was very lucky that the University of Puerto Rico was very eclectic, University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez, so one could design one's own research agenda. And I was also looking for good researchers, because not many people in that university really dedicated a lot of time to research. So they subsidized a lot of my projects. And that's when I did Women and Bisexuality, which is a collection of essays, peer-reviewed essays on women and bisexuality, a global perspective, essays from all over the world. And then I did Plural Loves, which is also a collection, Plural Loves, designs for bi and poly living. So how could you possibly live a life, design a life that includes bisexuality and polyamory? So then that, through that collection and the connections with the polyamorous communities and networks of the East Coast, that's how I kind of traveled into the polyamorous world. Because when I published this collection, it was in 2005, I think, then, it was a bit of a ticket into those communities, into presenting at their conventions, at their gatherings, and in making friends and connecting with those communities. In Puerto Rico, it was very difficult at that time. You know, much as the research agenda was open, the social life was conventional. People in Puerto Rico have extended families. They have huge families. And those are their friends. Their friends are their cousins, because they have so many of them that they don't need to look beyond. I mean, this is a bit reductive. I don't want to say that it's always like that, but it's common. And so importing, bringing in certain options was not easy, even though later on in the in the last few years that I was teaching there, we did that too. So we will get to that.
So you have the website, The Alchemies of Ecosexual Love, and then you're the founder of the school. So what exactly is ecosexual love?
Yes, thank you. First of all, you know, this word, the School of Ecosexual Love, is more of a dream for now than actually a reality. And I want to be very, very clear about it. It's a project that for now is, we have this yearly experiential retreat. And it's in its fifth edition. So that's all that there is, really. There isn't really a huge curriculum or a lot of graduates. There is an interesting beginning, and it could continue and expand. So it's a bit of a project, of a dream. Okay.
I've heard of things that do a lot less that are schools. So to me, that counts as a school. You've had, even if it's a retreat center, you're teaching something, you know. So
yes, definitely. My yearly experiential retreat, which I teach in different locations depending on where we find the right space, is what in Italian they call it a percorso. A percorso means it's like a path. It's not a festival. It's not an assemblage of things that are unrelated. It's like step by step. You know, it helps people to evolve from, or to deprogram from being programmed for monogamy, for monosexuality, for being programmed for in a certain way to fit a certain mold, to feeling, okay, do I really want to fit here? And if I don't, what else is possible? So, you know, it deprograms, and it also offers experiential alternatives so that people can say, hey, you know, if I want to redesign my life, this is what it would look like. And these are the kinds of things, the kinds of steps that I need to take, even to internally transform, so that then I can manage whatever comes my way. So in that sense, it is. But as I said, it's small for now. We hope that it expands. So ecosexual love, why did I put together these three memes, right? Eco, sex, and love. Ecology, sexuality, and love. Well, I want to be here too a little bit historical. We have to backtrack now to the early 10s and mostly to 2015. So in Puerto Rico, I taught for 20 years at the university. And then at some point, Deborah Annapol and I got to meet each other. You know about Deborah Annapol, right? One of the founders of the polyamorous movement, the first edition, which was before the AIDS crisis. We got together because she had published a book called Polyamory in the 21st Century. And I had published my book called Gaia and the New Politics of Love. Notes for a Poly Planet, which is a book that really theorizes the idea that if resources of love were shared, this would, were of course consensually shared in ways that people want to do, we would create abundance out of scarcity. Because basically, if you can share a bed, then you can share a car, then you can share a train, then you can share a house, and you can share so many different things. If you manage to share sustainably those things that are most intimate. So, and it's based on the theory of Gaia, which explains that we evolve symbiotically, meaning we evolve not by competition, but by collaboration. Okay, so it's there was this convergence of Deborah Annapol's book, my book, and then Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens. Okay, and Beth Stevens, who was a partner at that time and still is, and she's a professor at UC Santa Cruz. They were starting this series of weddings to the forces of nature, to the sun, to the snow, to the sea, to the sky, to the moon. Okay, so there was this kind of magical convergence where also Facebook was starting to, you know, it was a very open space at that time. So everybody met for some reason. There was this law of attraction. And so Deborah, myself, and Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens collaborated for a couple of years. And they were calling this ecosexuality. And I thought, wow, this is a great word. I love it. And so I liked the word. And, you know, we all went along for a while. And ecosexuality then at some point for me was, it wasn't my own thing. For one thing, it was something that they had put on the platforms, right? So it belonged to them in some ways. Even though, of course, nobody owns words, but still there was something that was their specialty in some ways. Plus, to me, ecosexuality alone sounds too much like identity. Okay, all these words, you know, one thing is a bisexual behavior, bisexual community, but bisexuality per se, there's something that is identitarian about it. And identities bring people together, but they also separate, you know, who is in and who is out. So one thing is behavior and one thing is identity. And I tend to stay a little, you know, to distance myself a little bit from identities because they bring this danger, right? That they create these little micro identities and then people get locked into their little holes, right? So I thought, well, you know, how can I use ecosexual in a discursive space where it is not the object, it's not the noun, but it's more like an adjective, right? A descriptor. Okay. So I said, well, you know, in all my books, there's the word love because that's really what interests me. So I said, okay, ecosexual love does it. That's how. Okay. And it turned out that it had all these three ingredients. The ecology, which is something that really I'm passionate about. What does it mean? You know, ecology is about things that move. And ecology is something where the tropes that are part of it circulate. Okay. And there is a balance in this movement. It's a movement that is circular that comes back to the first place. And then there is sexuality, which is vital energy, is really very important. And love, which is, you know, the heart is what makes us passionate, is what is the flame, the sun, you know, the energy within us. So that's how it came to be. It had all these different things. In a way, you know, I am a child of the 60s. And so, you know, ecosexuality was a way to also recuperate our past as girls who were often, we had our first sex in the parks because it was done at the time. It sounded, you know, the hyper ecosexual thing. We could say, oh, I lost my virginity in a park, you know. So, okay, you make love in a park.
Yeah.
Ecosexual love. Because it did have it, because it was common in that time. Of course, mm-hmm. Then with the AIDS crisis, you know, all these places where people had public sex, they became all policed, so it stopped. Yeah. It was a whole generation that never really had that enjoyment of smelling the grass while you're having an orgasm, which is amazing, right? Yeah. It was rolling the hay, so or rolling the park. So that was, it was something that I thought would be a good vehicle for me to bring the contents that I wanted. Did I answer your question? Yeah.
Yeah, I like the fact that, you know, ecosexual love, it's not only just like a term, it's less than an identity. It's almost like just a series of connections. And yeah. I like that concept.
Yes, exactly. It's not an identity. It's a series of connections. So it puts, like, creates a bit of a map where people can locate themselves and they can pick one, emphasize one or another, or still another part of that phrase. Yes.
Definitely. I like that it feels like getting back to roots, you know, of where we should be as human beings.
Yes.
And kind of in communion with the earth that we come from and each other. I like that concept of how we're all bound together. You know, we're all part of the same organism, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yes, I want to add a comment here. I'm in Italy. I have been here for the longest time. I mean, I used to travel to different countries every year, but since the COVID crisis, I've been kind of stuck here for some reason, and also accepting it, you know, mm-hmm. not okay with that. But I'm reading a book by one of the leaders of the resistance movement here. His name is Michele Giovagnoli, and it's called The Alchemy of the Forests. And one of the point, or something like that, you know, something alchemic in the forest or the woods. And what he says is that basically going into the woods is like a trip in our subconscious. You know, that when we relinquish all these things that make us related to material things, you know, that in the wood, we basically explore the inner world.
Yeah.
Because that's what the wood brings out, is our origin. You know, the origins where life begins, right? Where we evolve from. So it's been a beautiful reading, very ecosexual, one could say, even though I don't know that you would even
I was reading something on the internet probably about research they've done on people who even have pictures of forest in their house. It lightens them. It helps alleviate depression. It doesn't alleviate depression. I mean, some of us, you know, really have to work on that one. But so spending time outside really does wonders for your soul, your mindset.
And one of the gifts of this COVID era is that, you know, since our social life is a bit on the low side, then we relate in a different ways to animals and also to the natural world. We resource them for our, you know, for many of the things that before we used to go to human beings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love forest bathing, for example. Now I live in the Prealps, so there are many beautiful woods nearby. And I'm starting to do more forest bathing based on the leadership of this book, because it's a bit of a manual that tells you what to do.
Forest bathing is just being out in the woods?
Yes, forest bathing is, yes, of course you can walk in the wood, you know, like most people do, but forest bathing is when you stop, you lie down, and then you start seeing, you know, you see the trees in the sky.
Oh, nice.
You look up and the trees are, you know, with their branches are there. They do different designs with the sky. And then you start smelling and also hearing the sounds of the wood, which doesn't happen when you're walking because you're moving. So
you hear
your steps. So forest bathing is like, you know, like when you sunbathe, right?
Just
walk on the beach or sunbathe, that's when you forest bathe.
So like when you feel the sun on your skin is sunbathing, and when you feel the forest around you would be forest bathing. I like the idea of just standing out in the woods and sitting or standing.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. I love that.
Yeah.
That's such a great idea.
We already talked a bit about your school. You know, I was going to ask how did the idea come about, but also what are your ideas for the school in the future? Because you talked about, well, you know, you have this idea in your head. What's the idea in your head? Where are you going with the
thank school? You yes, I would love to address that. Well, I want to go use memory again. When I retired from University of Puerto Rico, it was 2017, and I decided to, for, you know, usually I would go from, say, Puerto Rico to New York, and then from New York to Paris, from Paris to Rome. That would be my summer trip. because, you know, when I finished my teaching, I would go across the Atlantic and come back to Europe for one reason or another, including that my one daughter and her children live in Rome. So that's a good excuse, right? But this time I said, okay, I want to go the other way. So I left Puerto Rico, I went to Oregon, and then I went to Hawaii. And in the meanwhile, a very big hurricane happened in Puerto Rico. And the island was in a blackout for 4 months, which you might remember.
Oh, yeah.
So it was in the middle of the ocean, which is true, but not exactly in the middle of the Atlantic. But in any event, it wasn't a good idea to go back because, you know, if you can't be part of the solution, then you are part of the problem. Yeah. There was no electricity on the island. So I decided, okay, I'll go the other, you know, the other way. And so from Hawaii, then I went to Thailand and I stayed at the Tao Garden, which is in Chiang Mai, North Thailand. It's a school of Tao. It was founded by Mantak Chia, one of the biggest, most significant teachers of modern Tao, who also was from Bangkok and grew up in New York, and then founded this school near Chiang Mai. And that's where this whole fourth element came in for me. I want to say we talked about eco-sexual love, but where was the fourth element? I was missing one piece because I knew everything about, you know, considering the other a temple, consider the body a temple, you know, from Tantra, you learn that those whoever you meet is, the person is a temple of their soul, so you respect that. Mm-hmm. And then polyamory, I had been very familiar with that, bisexuality. So those were the three elements, but there I found the fourth element, which is the Tao, however you want to pronounce it, which is a very ancient science and practice about how to take care of your own personal ecosystem. In fact, the promise of Tao is wealth, health, and longevity. Okay, so it teaches you a bunch of techniques about how to take care of your own biome, as we would say today. Okay, and so I was looking for a combination of elements that would help people drop their fears of falling in love or being present in the scene of love or enjoying love or you know, practicing some form of love. Okay, so when I was at the Tao Garden, I found it. I said, okay, it's the Tao, it's what I'm missing. So that's how the whole idea of the alchemy of ecosexual love came. Because I found this fourth element, which is actually the first element, right? And then the whole picture became complete. So that's how I invented this this course called The Alchemy of Ecosexual Love or Alchemies of Ecosexual Love that has four elements. The first is, and it's designed for people to overcome their fear of love. Often, you know, we try our best, like, you know, we fall in love, we become passionate. I mean, we're all out being present on the scene of love and something hurts and then we retreat, right? Yeah. And sometimes we go back, but sometimes we don't. Sometimes there's just too much fear doing that. So I wanted to create something that would help people overcome that fear. Of course, that's then. Now I wouldn't even describe it that way, but fear is strong. And if you can transform fear into love, you really become generous and courageous and abundant. And also you can take care of yourself. So the idea was that there were four fears and these four elements would enable people to overcome each one of them. So the Tao, with the care of our own ecosystem, the inner smile, the practice of the inner smile helps overcome the fear, like the idea, you know, of falling in love or love sickness. Yeah. Love makes you sick, right? How do you come back to yourself, right? And heal yourself from whatever trace of sickness some disappointment has left you with, right? So that's the first element. The second element was the tantra. So that helps to overcome the fear of rejection. Like, you know, you love somebody and you want to go toward them and then they say no. How do you feel gratitude for a no, right? Somebody tells you no, it's because they're taking care of themselves. They are appreciating their own tempo. It's not a rejection of you. It's that they're taking care of themselves. So you feel that gratitude.
Yes.
And of course, that creates abundance, because if people feel they can say no to you, then they'll say yes at some point. Because I won't be afraid to say no, but at some point they'll say, oh, okay, this proposal, I like it. So I'm going to say yes. But
that, or maybe, you know, sometimes when you get a no, it's actually a blessing, because that's not the right relationship for you. You know?
Exactly. You
and
could
that
be doing
asserting that.
Right. Often it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, if it's not meant to be a yes, it will be a no. Mm-hmm. But you don't feel diminished by that. You don't feel rejected by that. You feel, okay, it's a blessing. This person said no. I can go somewhere else, look for what I want. It wasn't the right door to knock. So, and then the other two elements, which I called amorous inclusiveness, which sounds very elaborate. It's another word for polyamory, but it's also a way to put it on a different dimension. Okay, so amorous inclusiveness could apply anywhere in different times and places, whereas polyamory is often like this community here and that community there. Great. And then sexual fluidity, which is another word for bisexuality, right? If you are capable of fluctuating, sometimes you're more on this side and sometimes you're more on that side, right? Everybody who has experienced bisexuality, we know that it's not symmetrical. It's not 50-50. Sometimes you really are, you know, in one space. And sometimes you're in another space.
And sometimes you just don't want anybody near you at all.
Right.
At least not sexually.
And it doesn't mean, you know, at all times, if you think you're bisexual, you're still bisexual.
Yeah.
You don't have to practice it, you know, in combination all the time.
Yeah, but so, it's about like capability, not actual practice, you know.
Right, it's about the potential. And there was this study by Lisa Diamond at that time, which was called Sexual Fluidity. And I thought that was very, it was about 100 women that she had followed for 10 years to really register their sexual behavior. So it was really very much about sexual fluidity, especially for women, but also for men. And so that was how the alchemy of ecosexual love came into being. Like if we can combine these four elements alchemically, right, we will have some kind of formula that will empower people to feel, you know, to express their potential for love at all times and in different circumstances and also in different age groups.
Excuse me. So, it sounds like a very, you know, obviously the point is inclusivity, which is, you know, a very long range, all encompassing sort of concept, which again, like, you know, the term it's about connections, which is, I like that, you know, and you'd mentioned about, you know, identities kind of closing people off or enclose ourselves off. This seems to kind of almost counter that idea where you can still have the identity, but still be open to everybody and everything, which I think I really like that.
Yeah.
In fact, the sexual inclusiveness or inclusivity has this double meaning, right? Basically, in polyamory, we practice compersion, right? Compersion is that, you know, simplified is the opposite of jealousy, but it's really the ability to feel joy for the joys that our partners experience, even if we're not the source of that, right? it's a bit like parents, you know, parents who really love you are happy for you, even though, you know, whatever makes you happy may take you away, right? It's not non-possessive way of love, wishing that love that empowers somebody to express their potential. So, you know, amorous inclusiveness is really about being able to be a conduit for that expansion of the energy of love, for not locking it in between a he and a she, or a he and he, or she and a she, or, you know, whatever the combination, but between the two persons in an initial relationship, right? So it goes beyond beyond monogamy, but it doesn't really but there is some exclusivity, because in polyamory there is exclusivity. Each relationship is very special and different and has its own little, you know, secrets, the parts of it that are exclusive, right? But then there is also a wider energy field where all these different energy fields between all the different people live, right? Mm-hmm. And the wider energy field really sustains all these different energy fields between the people who are in relationship. So that's the ability. It's the ability to allow this energy to always expand. And that happens when you start contemplating, because when two people are amorous with each other, it's just so beautiful to watch. If you're beyond your ego,
yeah,
it becomes like a live museum where you see all these beautiful people manifesting their love. And then your turn comes at some point. So if you think of that, then you don't think, oh, why is it not me now? It, you know, so just have some patience. So often we do exercises that are based on that, and they give people the experience of being the receiver, the giver, mm-hmm. or the witness. And the witness is really the role that is most challenging for people, but it's also the more powerful and advanced role if you can handle it.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of maturity to,
right,
you know, that I don't know that I'm capable of at the moment, let alone anybody else. But it sounds like you work on that. That's what you're working on, is getting to that level.
Right, right. Being that role of that witness is, the, you know, the witness could be somebody who feels pushed out, who feels excluded, who feels jealous, who wondered, why am I not a giver or receiver at this time? But if you move the energy from the dantian to the heart, mm-hmm. then you find that you have a lot of power as a witness. Because if you contemplate with love, the beauty of what you're contemplating will become more intense. See, and then there will be the gratitude of those who have been appreciated as, you know, in their expression. Mm-hmm. And then when your turn comes, somebody will hold the space for you. In a way, when we hold events, when we host spaces where people can express their love, we always do that. We create safe spaces for people to express their love. And that's a great gift to them. And it requires a lot of compassion, because we're not there for our own enjoyment. Our enjoyment may be just to know that these people are filling their oxytocin tanks.
Right.
But we're not there to just participate. We have this bigger role, which is holding the space.
Yeah.
Like you, for example, you are hosting a podcast, right? Mm-hmm. You are creating contents that will empower people. So you are holding the space.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm gonna say it. You can learn something too, but you know, there's nothing wrong with watching and learning.
Right, Right. In the bisexual forum, we used to say voyeurism is a form of participation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
One thing is voyeur, that is, you know, your neighbor, the peeping Tom with the binoculars,
yeah,
watching your window from their window. And one thing is to be in this beautiful space where people are, you know, like in the film Short Bus. I don't know if you remember it.
No, I didn't see that one.
Amorous inclinations, and you're there and you watch, but you're part of it, you smell.
Yeah,
it's
a consensual watching too. I like that consent is thrown in all over the place here. It's you're invited to watch, and you're allowing the space for two people to be sexual with each other, and so it's two way. It's the person watching and the people being watched both have consent there, you know, which is different from the guy who, if my neighbor ever does that, it's going to be a problem. But yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, in all the retreats of the Alchemy of Ecosexual Love, we always start with consent. That's why you see the wheel of consent that was invented by Betty Martin, who is a sexual educator. Sex positive educator based in Seattle. She actually has a school of consent in Seattle, and with permission, this was translated and adapted for Italian speakers. There are about 60 million people who use this language, and only maybe 5% could have followed in English. So it's just a way to expand this tool, the effect of this tool, and to really articulate consent in these four quadrants. Often we think that if we are in action, we are giving, but we may be taking. We think that if we are receptive, how is that? I get confused. In any way, the simple thing is that there is action and gift. When they go in the same direction, it's like a pure exchange. Like, you know, you receive a massage and I give you a massage.
Yeah.
The gift and the action go in the same direction. But if, say, you know, my partner wants to have penetrational sex and I'm not, but I say, okay, let's do it, then I can still like it, but then I am allowing something, right? And that person is taking something, right? Even though he is in action. So we have the gift and the action that go in opposite directions, right? Which doesn't mean that we can't enjoy it. We can, of course, right? But being aware of this gives so many people keys to what their behavior is received as, you know, to what they are being in the world or what they are being in bed. And it gives them a chance to move instead of being stuck in one place, you know, always permitting, but never getting what you really want because you don't ask or you don't even know.
Right.
Okay, today is my turn. I'm going to tell you what it is that I want. Can you give it to me? See, so it's really very liberating to work with this this wheel of consent, which is, I've created this precisely so that I can start my retreat.
That sounds very helpful. I'm going to have to look this up in English when I get done here. I'll probably try to post a link to it if I can find it.
I was about to say we should probably put that in the show notes. That's, I think, a good resource right there.
Yeah,
there is an article on my website which is in English also. I can send you that link, but then if you Google Betty Martin, you find this in English everywhere.
Awesome.
So it's public domain. Cool. She has a whole school, so there are so many more elaborate levels that you can get trained in consent, but this is the basic, and it's more of a public domain.
That's cool. Yeah.
Very cool.
Even though I like to give credit to women who invent things, because often
Yeah, we don't get the credit.
No, that's very true. Need to give credit where credit is actually due.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's such a capitalist thing. You know, if you work for a company and you make a product while you're at work, you don't get credit for it. The company owns it. And that's that's kind of bled into everyday life.
So many things.
But women, it's always been like that. Your husband gets the credit for it, you know.
Yeah.
Unless it's food. Women have always kept the credit for their food. But yeah, you do offer events, and they, you know, you can see that one that was for 2021 or planned for 2021 on your website, for example.
Yeah, my website hasn't been updated yet. The new date is August 24th to the 28th.
Okay.
Yeah. And so for 2022.
Okay. And, so what would my experience as a bisexual person, and even a monogamous person, be like going into this setting, if I, you know, just random bisexual person off the street that maybe has no experience with this or has a lot of baggage, what would it be like?
Yeah, I think we touched on some of that, and that is, in particular, the beginning would be a deprogramming, right? Really visualizing oneself. Why have we been programmed for monosexuality and for monogamy? Where does this programming come from? Does it come from our inner world? Does it come from our inclination, from our desire? Or does it come from a limitation that has been imposed because it's a social norm?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there will be certain practices that help you look into this. And then in the different steps, there will be exercises that get you to experience in your body a different way. Like the one I mentioned before, separating the roles, giver, receiver, witness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you're a giver, you're not a receiver. You are 100% receiving. Okay. If you're a witness, you're not interfering. You're contemplating. You are getting to the space of compersion. Okay. Then, so that's the monogamy, deconstructing monogamy. Mm-hmm. Right. Then deconstructing monosexuality. If you have a group of three, two are going to be most likely of similar gender. Because, of course, gender is a spectrum, but then, on a spectrum between male and female. So then you may be a giver for somebody of your gender, and maybe you've never done that. Maybe it's the first time that you touch, you know, you touch somebody's face with a loving touch, and you feel the eroticism of that, even though the gender is the same. So you get to be in a safe space where you can experience the emotions, the trepidation of that, and feel supported.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like it's a gift to yourself. It's a gift to the group. And then you can share about it. And so, it can be life-changing to do that. And it's something that often comes up in the comments, especially for men. Even though I want to say that in these courses, when they're like 2 days or 3 days or even 4 days, we stay on a level of which in sex positive education would be level two, maximum level three. Namely, you know, level one is when you chatter. Mm-hmm. Level two is when it can be a bit sensual. Level three is when it can be erotic. And level four is when there could be actual genital sex with penetration and everything. So we don't go there.
Oh, okay.
We do that at home or in their rooms, but we don't facilitate that. But we do facilitate this sense of the erotic, the loving touch, regardless of the gender of the person. You begin that practice of loving the person, not the gender, which is, you know, bisexuality at the highest level. Because often in bisexuality, when we become aware of our bisexuality, we want to compensate, right? That whole part that we've missed, we want a lot of that.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there is that loving the person. Mm-hmm. You love the person. It doesn't matter what the body is like. It's, you know, what the plumbing is like is irrelevant. So that's what a bisexual person would experience. And I can tell you that for me to bring this in Italy has been a challenge and a pleasure, because it's a culture where people are not so open about their orientation. It's not like, you know, they'll tell you what their orientation is. You have to guess and kind of smell it. I don't know.
Yeah.
So for people to have that chance to do these practices with that level of awareness and with that sacred container of the temple of consent is wonderful, because then they actually bond. A whole network of brothers and sisters is created of people who connect with each other, who see each other again. And so there's a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question. I hope
that does. It does. You know, I was looking, I'm like, wow, that there's bisexual people there, you know. And I noticed that you said something about bisexual on the website, bisexuality, and then I found the translate button and couldn't find it again, but anyway, I'm sure it's there.
Definitely bisexuality is an element of that alchemy. It's called sexual fluidity because you know, the idea is that anybody could sign up, even somebody want to identify as bisexual, because they're not there, you know.
Well, if it's all consent-based too, I mean, you could probably get there and decide, hey, that's not for me, and never.
Exactly. Because people can sign up, and then each practice is an invitation. So they could simply watch and not participate in some of the proposition, some of the offerings. Yes.
Okay. Let's get to those books, because you've written a ton, and what books have you written? Let's just talk about all the books you've written, because it seems like they're all related to ecosexual love.
They're related to ecosexual love and also to bisexuality. Okay. The ones I mentioned before, Women and Bisexuality, A Global Perspective, and Plural Loves, Designs for Bi and Poly Living. Those are books I orchestrated as an editor. So they're not books I wrote 100%. They were collections made of contributions that were received based on a call for papers. And at that time, Fritz Klein, who was the founder of the Bisexual Forum of San Diego, he was editing the Journal of Bisexuality for Haworth Press, which was, I think, somewhere in the mountains in New England. Anyway, it was a small press, and they asked him to edit this journal. So sometimes the journal would do a special topics issue. And so those two books were born like that. One was, you know, Women and Bisexuality. It was initially a journal issue, and then it was also published as a book so that more people would read it, because the idea was that these were peer-reviewed academic journals, but they had a mission beyond the walls of academia. They had the mission of connecting with the communities that were seeking sources that would validate their practices and their intuition. And that's what I did as an academic from the University of Puerto Rico. As I said, you know, before, queer theory versus bisexuality.
Yeah, that's, you know, I noticed that about bisexual anthologies in general. They're not overly academic. They're very accessible.
Right. And sometimes they're made by activists who have nothing to do with the academic world, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know, Robin Oakes. I mean, very cultured, very knowledgeable people, but they don't occupy an academic position, right? So my role was a bit different, because the works I did were born as peer-reviewed academic studies, right? But then they also had this open window because the contributions came from people who had a passion for this theme, right? And the perspectives were very multidisciplinary, so that there was a hologram, right? So that all the different viewpoints were included. And I would say they were organic collections because they were not just an assemblage of essays. It was a common theme, and often we did very deep revisions so that there would be a resonance between all the different essays that were included in one given collection. So that was, it was my intent. I don't know if it's completely successful, but I hope I did a good job. The subsequent special topics issue was Plural Loves, Designs for Bi and Poly Living. I remember that at one point I called Fritz Klein and I said, you know, I think there is a lot of overlap, a lot of resonance between the world of polyamory and the world of bisexuality. So I want to try and do something that really goes to the interests of this, right? See who wants to break a lance and write on these two themes and the interconnection. And that's how that that special topics issue happened and then was turned into a book, always by Haworth Press. Then at one point I started writing this memoir. It was called Eros. Eros, the first title was A Journey of Multiple Loves. So it was my story, basically, that ended. Very cool. Ended with, I think it ended with when I left San Diego in 1997, but then there was a coda that was, a story that happened much later. And I sent it to Fritz and Regina, who was also very important in the founding the Bisexual Forum of San Diego. And she was also a student of Fritz Klein, Regina Reinhardt. And I said, oh, wow, this is an amazing book. And so we published it with Haworth Press. Right. Then Haworth Press was bought, at some point. I think the first time Eros was published, I think it was 2006. So Haworth Press was still Haworth Press. So it wasn't a conglomerate. Mm-hmm. It really was doing some grassroots, connecting with the grassroots type of work, as I said before. But then the big conglomerates happened. So Taylor and Francis bought a bunch of smaller presses, okay? And then it created a bunch of subheadings. It all belonged to Taylor and Francis, but then everything that had to do with LGBT studies was subsumed under Routledge, which had been an sort of independent press that really had broken new ground when the discipline of LGBT studies became existent in the academic world, when queer theory and all of that became significant. Then, of course, no academic press would touch it. So Routledge came about and said, okay, we will do that. So all the books that were part of Haworth Press became Routledge books. And they were owned by Taylor and Francis, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Including my memoir, but it was not priced like a memoir because, people, when they buy a memoir, they want to read a story, they're going to spend $20, not $50.
Yeah.
So, it was kind of stuck there. So at some point, I requested the rights back. And so now I have a new edition. In fact, it's called now Eros, the Wisdom of Love. So I did a new preface and the text is the same and it has a new subtitle and it's published independently. So that's one thing. Then I can tell you about this other collection that we did in those years, started in those years when Deborah Annapol, Annie Sprinkle, Beth Stevens, they were doing these weddings to the forces of nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at that point, I had this idea, okay, we could break new ground with this word, ecosexuality, do a call for papers, a call for contributions, and see who wants to break a lance and feels that they have something to say on this topic. And that's how that collection was born. Ecosexuality, when nature inspires the arts of love, which has the Botticelli Venus, the famous painting, that woman with the red hair. That
yeah.
On the cover. And that I did with Lindsay Hageman, who, you know, would be the age at that time to be a student of mine or maybe a few years older. And she lived in a community in South Washington State. She lived in an ecosexual community.
Oh, at that
wow. time. I think they would call themselves that way at that time. And so it was a great collaboration. And we accepted everything we received, even things that needed a lot of work. So we worked with these, you know, would-be authors. Some of them yeah. were not experienced. Yeah. So that we could have this orchestration of a number of themes and sub-themes of tropes that resonated with each other, organized in different parts, and that every voice would be heard. That's why it's a book that is a bit thick. Perhaps mm-hmm. if I did it again, I would make it thinner, you know. But then it's also a register of what happened at that time. Who was willing to break a lance on this word at that time? It was, right. was in 2015. In fact, there is a researcher at the University of Utrecht, who also interviewed me, and he said he really liked that book because it's a bit like a photograph of that movement at that
time. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I could definitely see that.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you want me to talk about how I started, you know, my first book is called The Weak Subject, weak in commas. It's on women playwrights of the 19th century, of the 20th century.
Wow.
And it really, nice. You can say, it's really funny because this was a book that came from my doctoral dissertation. And when I was part of the Bi Forum, my mind was activated because that was the piece I was missing. You know, why did I like these plays so much written by women? Because often there were two women who were very close.
Yeah.
They could be sisters or sisters-in-law or maybe partners in business or partners in a school, for example, like in The Children's Hour, that famous play by Lillian Hellman. And there was something between them was very strong. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a homoerotic or maybe some bisexual energy between them, some mm-hmm. way that they had to connect that was more profound than just, you know, what was allowed by the rules of their society at that time. And so when I was part of the Bisexual Forum, all of this became easy to put together. So that book was my first, The Weak Subject, which was then translated also in Italian. And after the collection Ecosexuality, I have another book, but I haven't published it yet because I've been lazy, perhaps. it's called Alchemies of Ecosexual Love. But now I started a new book and it's called Pandemics of Love.
Pandemics of Love.
Yes. And it's in Italian. So those are in the works. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to prognosticate when they're going to happen because things are so unforeseeable.
Yes.
You know? Oh,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
My daughter's looking for a job, and I don't know why people ask this question in the first place, but this interview question that's like the perennial interview question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Okay, this is the generation that did, you know, you don't know where you're going to see yourself next week, let alone 5 years from now. It's like,
right.
Last year has been so unpredictable and just wild. So
yeah, especially when it comes to publishing, it's, you know, you don't know it until it actually happens. So
yeah, Anything else we missed that you'd like to discuss? Tell us again about the upcoming event in August.
Yes, that will be, the dates are August 24th to 28th. And people can also stay until the 29th, which is a Monday. Mm-hmm. It's in the vicinity of Rome in the what is called the Castelli Romani, which is the hills to the south of Rome, which are also where some of the patricians, the Roman patricians, had their villas.
Oh,
they're very nice. So
yeah. These beautiful volcanic lakes. So it's a very nice resort that we have booked. And it will be from Wednesday evening to Sunday after lunch. And actually people of all nationalities are welcome, provided they speak either English or Italian, or maybe even French. And if we get mixed language group, we will put the people who need some translation together with people who speak the language that mm-hmm. they understand, and then there will be a little bit of help like that. There won't be like a professional, word by word translation, but there will be support mm-hmm. in participating and understanding what we are doing.
Okay.
And so, and we love diversity, so we welcome people of different origins. And in the first years that I did this this course, I had really a balance. Often I had people from all different countries in Europe. Now it's more difficult to travel, but there are many foreign language people who live in Italy for one reason or another. So everyone is welcome that wants to participate. Yes.
Cool. That sounds
very cool. Yes. Yeah.
And I also have another, well, I want to put it out there. Yes. This year I have this intent. I don't know what will happen because, as I said, we live in a very unpredictable times and things could be a lot better than you could possibly imagine, or they could disappear.
Yeah.
My intent is to create here in Italy, in connection with people of the newly founded Commissione Dubbio e Precauzione, Commission for Doubt and Precaution, mm-hmm. which is, a scientific position, right? That science is always about doubt, and it's also about precaution, because you don't want to blow up the whole planet. The idea is to create a symposium on the theory of Gaia, which is an epistemic theory based in science. It's a theory that really turns around all the foundations of knowledge from a certain age to a different age. So it's also a theory that helps us transition from the age of the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarium, right? Where all the foundations of knowledge that we believe are true without questioning, mm-hmm. we can find out that maybe they're not.
Okay.
The way it happened, in the era of Galileo, when people thought that the Earth was at the center and then they realized it wasn't.
Right.
So a symposium that has as a focus this theory, which is, again, an epistemic theory, but based on science, based on the American scientist, Lynn Margulis, the British scientist, James Lovelock, then can galvanize a lot of different voices from different disciplines so that the world can become more aware of what the multiple ways out of the COVID emergencies can be.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. It's very ambitious, but I am making the connections to make it happen. So then I want to do this book, Pandemics of Love. So there will be the theory, and then the practice will be the alchemies of ecosexual love. So,
that's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
A textbook. Yeah. Bring your textbook. Yeah.
Well, no, it's not meant as a textbook.
No. Okay.
Whoever wants to read that, it's a way to express a position, right?
Yeah.
So where my voice is present at this moment. But then the symposium would be the theory, right? And then the alchemies of love, the experiential retreat would be for those who really feel that they want to take one more step, just not in the mind, but also in their bodies, then that further step.
Okay.
So that's my program. Bring me some
it's,
luck.
It's very interesting stuff that you do. I just saw that. I'm like, I've got to know more about this.
It's all really interesting. And, you know, I was hoping for the coming year that you're able to make all these things happen.
I want to close with this. And this is something I get from my studies of the ancients. Bisexuality is essential because getting to know an other who is like you is getting to know you.
True.
I like that.
A true essential experience of being human. Mm-hmm. And you call it in whatever way you want. It doesn't matter.
I like that. Yeah.
Very cool.
Well, Dr. Serena Anderlini D'Onofrio, thank you for joining us today. We've really had a great time.
Yes.
And find out more about Dr. Serena and her work on the website, Alchemies of Ecosexual Love at ecosexlove.org. And thanks as always to my co-host, Mick Collins. Check out his new book, Verum Malum. I'm Elizabeth Meacham. Remember, there's a whole Bi Plus universe ready to embrace you. Reach out and find your community. Thank you.